We're continuing this evening in my series that from Matthew's Gospel, and we've been working through the Sermon on the Mount, and we come tonight to chapter 5, verses 27 to 30. Let me remind you that the theme on the Sermon on the Mount is "Do not be like them." We find those words right in the heart of the sermon. Do not be like them. Christians are called to be different. Jesus is here not speaking to the world. He's specifically addressing his disciples, those whom he has called out of the world. And he is saying to them, you are to be different. And he sets out ways in which they are to be different. You are to be different from the religious people among whom you live. And you are to be different from the pagans among whom you live. And he makes it clear that our difference is defined by God's law. He says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And then he goes on and he makes a most remarkable, a most astonishing statement. A statement that would have caused his hearers, I think, to gasp and to wonder. Because he says, for I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, the scribes and the Pharisees were regarded as the most righteous of the Jews. The word Pharisee, we think, means separated one. And they separated themselves from the common people in order to pursue God's law and to keep God's law. And they sought to keep it down to the minutest detail. Even tithing, we read in the Gospels, even tithing their garden herbs. You pick some mint, one-tenth of what you pick belongs to the Lord. That's how strict they were in their obedience to the law. But Jesus says, in your obedience to the law, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. How can that be? And he goes on and explains it. That their righteousness was one of outward obedience. And he required obedience from the heart. Last time I was with you, which is 2 months ago now, we looked at the matter of murder and saw that the commandment, you shall not murder, does not just mean you shall not physically put someone to death, but you shall not hate them, and you shall not slander them. You shall not be angry with them. In other words, it goes to the heart. And he goes on tonight and says the same is true of the commandment following, you shall not murder, the commandment that says, you shall not commit adultery. Now, these verses where he talks of this, verses 27 to 30, four verses, divide neatly into two sections, each of two verses. In verses 27 and 28, he's telling us we suffer a serious disease. That serious disease is called sin. And then in the two verses that follow, verses 29 and 30, he prescribes the cure for that disease. And the cure for that disease is to excise it, to cut it out. This is like a cancer. You don't fool with it. You cut it out. You remove it. You attack it with all you've got, or it will destroy you. So let's look at those two sections. First of all, verses 27 and 28, where we see the problem, the disease, sin. You have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not commit adultery." But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And here he is saying, you can't go around saying, well, I'm a godly man and I've obeyed the commandments as the rich young ruler did since I was a child, because I've never committed the physical act of adultery. Because if you have looked at another with lust, you've already committed adultery, he says, in your heart. In other words, we're guilty of breaking the sixth commandment. Now, it's very necessary that we understand what Jesus is not saying and what he is saying, or we can mess up our Christian lives. First of all, let's look at what he is not saying. We must not make Jesus say more than he is saying. Sometimes Christians, especially sincere and committed Christians, can do that. There is not the slightest, and have done that indeed, there is not the slightest suggestion that natural sexual relations within the commitment of marriage are anything but God-given and beautiful. Sex is not Satan's gift. It's God's gift to us. And like all his gifts, it's a good gift given for our good. Right? We must remember that in the canon of Scripture, we find the Song of Solomon. And the Song of Solomon is no Victorian prudery, but rather the uninhibited delight of lovers, of bride and bridegroom for each other. We need to walk in the steps of our Puritan forebears. Back in the Middle Ages, sex was regarded as something by many intrinsically evil and to be avoided, and to live a celibate life was to live on a higher level of spirituality and holiness than to live a married life. A very good book which I commend to you is a book called Worldly Saints, The Puritans as They Really Were, by an American scholar, Leland Ryken. One of the chapters in the book is titled Marriage and Sex. And he says this: marriage sex was not only legitimate in the Puritan view, it was meant to be exuberant. William Gouge, one of the great Puritan pastors, said that married couples should engage in sex, I quote, with goodwill and delight, willingly, readily, and cheerfully, unquote. An anonymous Puritan claimed that when two are made one in marriage, they, and again I quote, may joyfully give due benevolence to one another as two musical instruments, rightly fitted to make a most pleasant and sweet harmony in a well-tuned consort, unquote. So we are to delight in sexual relations with our spouse. Another way of putting this is to say that we must distinguish between natural desire and sinful desire. God has given us a natural desire for the opposite sex. According to the literal meaning of the Greek, the man here in Matthew, the man who is condemned is the man who looks at a woman with the deliberate intention of lusting after her. The man who is condemned is the man who deliberately uses his eyes to awaken his passion and his lust. We must distinguish, you see, between temptation and sin. I like the way Martin Luther put it. He said, you cannot stop the birds flying over your head, but you can stop them making nests in your hair. Right? We see someone and we think they're beautiful. And then comes the temptation. You see the bird flying over your head. Or perhaps it's landed with the temptation. They're desirable. I want them. And he says you can stop them making nests in your hair. You don't go on from the looking to the lusting. You stop. You look away if that's what's happening. You refuse to let your thoughts dwell there. So we have to be careful not to have Jesus say more than he's saying. It's not a sin to be tempted. It's a sin to give in to the temptation. And it's not a sin to have sex with your partner. That's God's gift to you, to be received gladly and joyfully. And like all his gifts, to be enjoyed. But while we must not make Jesus say more than he's saying, neither must we let him make him say less than he's saying. Some do that. We must not be over literal and argue that Jesus is talking only of a man lusting after a woman, and not a woman lusting after a man, or a man lusting after another man, or a woman lusting after another woman. Nor may we argue that he is speaking only of married persons, because he talks of adultery and not fornication, and adultery strictly is sex between persons who are married to another. This is to fall into the same mistake, the same error that Jesus is condemning in the Pharisees. Jesus' meaning is that any and every sexual practice which is immoral in act is also immoral in look and thought. So what did Jesus mean? Well, Jesus is saying that we can sin not only by what we do, but also by what we think. That sin consists not only of our deeds, but also of our thoughts. Jesus is saying that to look at another with lust is to commit sexual immorality with them in the heart. And you notice the connection between the eye and the heart. His point is that sexual immorality is not just act, but also eye and heart. And that eye adultery leads to heart adultery. And heart adultery is sin. Job recognized the importance of the eye. The most godly man in the Old Testament, a man who, according to God, was blameless. And in Job chapter 31, Job, who is protesting his innocence to his friends who have this theology that if you suffer, it's God's punishment for your sin. And he says in Job 31 and verse 1, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? And in verse 7, if my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes. You see there the connection between the eye and the heart. The heart follows the eyes, and my heart walked after the eyes. Or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let them sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. In other words, then I'm deserving punishment. But I've not done that. He goes on, if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow down over her. Then let me be punished if I've done these things. But I've not done these things. I've made a covenant with my eyes, and I've not let my heart go after another other than my wife. We need, when we're criticizing the Pharisees of Jesus' day, and we're right to do so because Jesus did, we have to be careful to recognize that throughout history, there have been godly Jews, and no doubt still are today, who have a right view of God's law. Here are some of the sayings of Jewish rabbis. The eye and the hand are the two brokers of sin. Eye and heart are two handmaids in sin. Passions lodge in him who sees. Woe to him who goes after his eyes, for they are adulterous. And so Jesus is saying the same things that many rabbis have said concerning the law. That it didn't just apply to the outward acts, but also to the heart. This is what Paul discovered, wasn't it? He said he wouldn't have known this if it were not for that 10th commandment. You shall not covet. Yes, perhaps you can read the commandment, you shall not commit adultery, and say, oh, that's the act. But when you get a bit further down, it says, you shall not covet, and among the things that are listed, you shall not covet, is your neighbor's wife. Then we see that the commandments do cover the heart and the desires of the heart. So Jesus is condemning the person who deliberately uses his eyes or her eyes to stimulate sinful desire. The person who seeks and finds delight in that which God forbids. In a sinful world, there are many things which are deliberately designed to excite and stimulate sinful lust. And it's much harder today, and especially much harder for young people today than it was for young people when I was a young man. We had girly magazines, but they were right at the back of the newsagent and in sealed plastic covers. And no one could just go in there and flick through them. But today there are books, there are magazines, there are movies, there are soap operas, there are websites, even advertisements that are deliberately designed and deliberately calculated to awaken and increase lust. People have jobs and they're paid money to stir up sinful lust. Jesus here reminds us that deeds of shame are preceded by fantasies of shame. And in fact, all that separates the fantasy from the deed is the opportunity. So that's the problem, and we see it's a very deep-seated problem. It's a problem of the heart. How do we deal with it? What do we do about it? And then Jesus gives his advice on what we're to do. He goes on in the next two verses. And he says, I've lost my place. Bear with me. You have heard, no, verse 29. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. This was evidently a favourite saying of Jesus, for he said it on a number of occasions. We find it again in Matthew's Gospel, in Matthew chapter 18 and verses 8 and 9, where he says, if your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into the everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hellfire. Here, the foot is added to the eye and hand, and the reference is not just to sexual sin, but to sin in general. Well, again, let's look at what Jesus did not mean, and then we'll look at what he meant. It's a startling command, isn't it, to pluck out an offending eye or to cut off an offending hand or foot. And throughout history, there have been Christians whose zeal has exceeded their wisdom and who have taken Jesus literally and have mutilated themselves in supposed obedience to this command. One of them was the great Church Father Origen of Alexander, who lived from 184 to 253 AD, we think, and made himself a eunuch In fact, this practice became so common in the early church that the Council of Nicaea, which met in AD 325 and is best known for the great Nicene Creed, had to pass a resolution forbidding it. Some time ago, I read a very interesting book by Simon Manchester called The Professor and the Madman, and subtitled A Tale of Murder, Insanity, and the Making of the Oxford English Dictionary. Have you read it? Yes. The compilation of the Oxford English Dictionary began in 1857. It was one of the most ambitious projects ever taken. And they collected examples of word usage from all and sundry who cared to send them in. As they were collected, the overseeing committee, led by Professor James Murray, who's the professor in the title, Professor and the Madman, discovered that one man, his name was W.C. Minor, had submitted more than 10,000 examples of word usage. And the committee decided that he needed to be honoured. But they then discovered that Dr. Minor, an American Civil War veteran, was also an inmate of an asylum for the criminally insane. He committed criminal acts. He was, however, a devout Christian. And believing he was obeying Jesus' command while in prison, he had castrated himself. Now, is that what Jesus is telling us? No. No, Jesus is not telling us to literally cut off our hand, or literally to pluck out our eye, or literally to excise any other member of our body. Right? Of course, the words of Jesus are not to be taken with crude literalism. Jesus loved dramatic figures of speech. He said, for example, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. He didn't mean that all his followers are to be walking down the street carrying heavy wooden crosses whenever they go out. He was, and likewise in this instance, he's not advocating a literal physical self-maiming, but rather a ruthless, radical self-denial. He's advocating not mutilation, but mortification. Not the removing of one's bodily parts, but the subduing of one's sinful lusts. It means rejecting and denying our sinful desires and practices so resolutely that we, as it were, put them to death. But what does this involve in practice? Let me elaborate. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out means this. If temptation comes to you through your eyes, don't look. Behave as if you had actually plucked out your eyes and chucked them away, and were now blind and could not see the thing which previously caused you to sin. If your right hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off means, if temptation comes to you through your hand, the things you do, don't do it. Or through your feet, the places you go, don't go there. Behave as if you had actually cut off your hands or cut off your feet and chucked them away, and now can no longer do the things you did or go to the places you went, which caused you previously to sin. Jesus is simply saying, if it causes you to sin, don't look, don't touch, don't go. In practice, this means that we will deliberately choose not to visit certain websites, not to read certain books or magazines, not to see certain movies, not to watch certain television programs, not to attend certain events. That is the meaning of mortification. Now, I want to be clear here. It's not for me, and it's not for the church to lay down for each member, I suggest, what they can see or where they can go, or not see or not go. Because we're all different. And what may cause one person to sin may not cause another person to sin. We need to know ourselves and to know our own hearts. And we need to watch ourselves and watch our hearts. But it certainly means, I suggest, that for all of us, there are places we will not visit, and things we will not do, and things we will not look at. For all of us, it means a restraint on what we do. Of course, this teaching of Jesus runs counter to today's standards of permissiveness. It's one of the things that makes it hard to be a Christian. It was always hard to be a Christian, and it always will be. We take up a cross and we follow Jesus. We deny ourselves certain pleasures that others allow themselves. If we follow Jesus' teaching, some of our friends may well regard us as narrow-minded, as Philistines, even as bigots. Look at the criticism that came on our Prime Minister when he said that his ministers were not to have sex with members of their office staff. He was accused of being a prude and going back to Victorian times. Well, so be it. Jesus was quite clear. It is better to lose a member of our body than to retain our whole body and go to hell. It's better to lose a friend than to have many friends and lose our body and our soul. The choice is based on simple Christian principles. As Christians, we have different principles and different priorities. As Christians, unlike the world around us, future glory is more important than present pleasure. Peace with God is more important than living in sin. Any sacrifice is worthwhile in this life if it helps us enter into eternal life. We don't eat, drink, and be merry because we know that though tomorrow we die, that's not for us the end. Now, I know this is hard, but I'm a human being like you, subject to the same temptations and the same weaknesses and the same struggles. I know this is hard. How can we do this when it's so hard? Well, let me read you from Paul in his letter to the Galatians. And in Galatians chapter 5, and all I can do now is read it, but this is such an important matter that next month, God willing, I will look at this passage. But he says, I say then, walk, Galatians 5:16, I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. We can't escape that lust of the flesh, but we can overcome it. How do we overcome it? By walking in the Spirit. He says, for the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. We'll look at what that means next time. Now, the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery. There it is, right at the head of the list. And by adultery, I suggest he means sexual immorality in general, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murder, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. And those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. So it's by walking in the Spirit and with the help of the Spirit, and only with his help, that we can deny these lusts of the flesh and not look and not touch and not go there. There's much more I would like to say, but like the oyster, I must know when it's time to close. And we'll close here.